Chapter 46. The Rain of Blood. As the jeweller returned to the apartment, he cast around him a scrutinising glance, but there was nothing to excite suspicion, if it existed not, or to confirm it, if already awakened. Caderousse's hand still grasped his gold and banknotes, and La Carconte called up her sweetest smiles while welcoming the reappearance of their guest. "Heyday," said the jeweller, "you seem, my good friends, to have had some fears respecting the accuracy of your money, by counting it over so carefully directly I was gone." "No, no," answered Caderousse, "that was not my reason, I can assure you, but the circumstances by which we have become possessed of this wealth are so unexpected as to make us scarcely credit our good fortune, and it is only by placing the actual proof of our riches before our eyes that we can persuade ourselves the whole affair is not a dream." The jeweller smiled. "Have you any other guests in your house?" inquired he. "Nobody but ourselves," replied Caderousse. "The fact is, we do not lodge travellers. Indeed, our tavern is so near to the town that nobody would think of stopping here." "Then I am afraid I shall very much inconvenience you." "Oh, dear me, no. Indeed, good sir, you will not," said La Carconte in her most gracious manner. "I vow and protest your passing the night under shelter of our poor roof will not make the slightest difference in the world to us." "But where will you manage to stow me?" "In the chamber overhead." "Surely that is where you yourselves sleep." "Never mind that. We have a second bed in the adjoining room." Caderousse stared at his wife with much astonishment. The jeweller, meanwhile, was humming a song as he stood warming himself by the bright, cheering blaze of a large faggot kindled by the attentive Carconte to dry the wet garments of her guest, and this done she next occupied herself in arranging his supper by spreading a napkin at the end of the table and placing on it the slender remains of their dinner, to which she added three or four fresh-laid eggs. Caderousse had once more parted with his treasures. The banknotes were placed in the pocket-book, the gold put back into the bag, and the whole carefully locked in the armoire, which formed his stronghold. He then commenced pacing the room with a pensive and gloomy air, glancing from time to time at the jeweller, who stood reeking with the steam from his wet clothes, and merely changing his place on the warm hearth to enable the whole of the garments to be in turns dried by the genial heat that issued from it. "Now then, my dear sir," said La Carconte, as she placed a bottle of wine on the table, "supper is ready whenever you are inclined to partake of it." "But you are going to sit down with me, are you not?" asked Johannes. "I shall not take any supper to-night," said Caderousse. "We dine so very late," hastily interposed La Carconte. "Then it seems I'm to eat alone," remarked the jeweller. "Oh, we shall have the pleasure of waiting upon you," answered La Carconte, with an eager attention she was not accustomed to manifest even to guests who paid for what they took. From one minute to another, Caderousse darted on his wife keen, searching glances, but rapid as the lightning flash. The storm still continued. "There, there," said La Carconte, "do you hear that? Upon my word, you did well to return hither." "Nevertheless," replied the jeweller, "if by the time I finish my supper the tempest has at all abated, I shall make another attempt to complete my journey." "Oh," said Caderousse, shaking his head, "there is not the slightest chance of its abating. It is the Mistral, and that will be sure to last till tomorrow morning." He then sighed heavily. "Well," said the jeweller, as he placed himself at table, "all I can say is so much the worse for those who are abroad and cannot obtain a shelter." "Ah," chimed in La Carconte, "they will have a wretched night of it, be they who they may." The jeweller commenced eating his supper, and the woman, who was ordinarily so querulous and indifferent to all who approached her, was suddenly transformed into the most smiling and attentive hostess. Had the unhappy man on whom she lavished her assiduities been previously acquainted with her, so sudden an alteration might well have excited suspicion in his mind, or at least have greatly astonished him. Caderousse, meanwhile, continued in gloomy silence to pace the room, sedulously avoiding the sight of his guest. But as soon as the stranger had completed his repast, the agitated innkeeper went eagerly to the door and opened it. "The storm seems over," said he. But as if to contradict his statement, at that very instant a violent clap of thunder seemed to shake the house to its very foundation, while a sudden gust of wind mingled with rain extinguished the lamp he held in his hand. Trembling and awe-struck, Caderousse hastily shut the door and returned to his guest, while La Carconte lighted a candle by the smouldering ashes that glimmered on the hearth. "You must be tired," said she to the jeweller. "I've spread a pair of my finest and whitest sheets on your bed, so you have nothing to do but to sleep as soundly as I wish you may. You can easily find your room. It is exactly over this." Johannes remained a short time listening whether the storm seemed to abate in its fury, but a brief space of time sufficed to assure him that, far from diminishing, the violence of the rain and thunder momentarily increased, Resigning himself, therefore, to what seemed inevitable, he bade his host good night and mounted to his sleeping apartment. As he passed over my head, the flooring seemed to creak beneath his tread, proving how slight must be the division between us. The quick, eager glance of La Carconte followed him as he ascended the staircase, while Caderousse, on the contrary, turned his back, and seemed most anxiously to avoid even glancing at him. All these particulars did not strike me as painfully at the time as they have done since. In fact, all that happened, with the exception of the story of the diamond, which certainly did wear an air of improbability, appeared natural enough and called for neither apprehension nor mistrust. But worn out as I was with fatigue, and fully purposing to proceed onwards directly the tempest abated, I determined to take advantage of the comparative silence and tranquillity that prevailed to obtain the refreshment of a few hours' sleep. Overhead, I could accurately distinguish every movement of the jeweller, who, after making the best arrangements in his power for passing a comfortable night, threw himself on his bed, and I could hear it creak and groan beneath his weight. Insensibly my eyelids grew heavy, deep sleep stole over me, and having no suspicion of anything wrong, I sought not to shake it off. For the last time I looked in upon the room where Caderousse and his wife were sitting. The former was seated upon one of those low wooden stools which, in country places, are frequently used instead of chairs. His back being turned towards me prevented me from seeing the expression of his countenance. Neither should I have been able to do so had he been placed differently, as his head was buried between his two hands. La Carconte continued to gaze on him for some time in contemptuous silence, then, shrugging up her shoulders, she took a seat immediately opposite to him. At this moment the expiring embers threw up a fresh flame from the kindling of a piece of wood that lay near, and a bright gleam was thrown on the scene and the actors in it. La Carconte still kept her eyes fixed on her husband, but as he made no sign of changing his position, she extended her hard, bony hand and touched him on the forehead. Caderousse shuddered. The woman's lips seemed to move as though she were talking, but whether she merely spoke in an undertone or that my senses were dulled by sleep, I did not catch a word she uttered. Confused sights and sounds seemed to float before me, and gradually I fell into a deep, heavy sleep. How long I had been in this unconscious state I know not, when I was suddenly aroused by the report of a pistol, followed by a fearful cry. Weak and tottering footsteps resounded across the chamber above me, and the next instant a dull, heavy weight seemed to fall powerless on the staircase. I had not yet fully recovered my recollection, when again I heard groans, mingled with half-stifled cries, as if from persons engaged in a deadly struggle. These evidences of the perpetration of some violent deed effectually roused me from my drowsy lethargy. Hastily raising myself on one arm, I looked around, but all was dark, and it seemed to me as if the rain must have penetrated through the flooring of the room above, for some kind of moisture appeared to fall drop by drop upon my forehead, and when I passed my hand across my brow, I felt it wet and clammy. To the fearful noises that had awakened me had succeeded the most perfect silence, unbroken save by the footsteps of a man walking about in the chamber above. By the creaking of the staircase, I judged the individual, whoever he was proceeding to the lower apartment. In another minute I heard some person moving there, and, looking through, I saw a man stooping towards the fire to light a candle he held in his hand. As he turned round, I recognised the features of Caderousse, pale, ghastly, and convulsed, while the front and sleeves of his dress were covered with blood. Having obtained the light he had evidently descended to seek, he hurried upstairs again, and once more I heard his rapid and uneasy step in the chamber above. Ere long he came below, holding in his hand the small shagreen case, which he opened to assure himself it contained the diamond. Seemed to hesitate as to which pocket he should put it in, then, as if dissatisfied with the security of either pocket, he deposited it in his red handkerchief, which he carefully rolled around his head. After this he took from his cupboard the bank notes and gold he'd put there, thrust the one in the pocket of his trousers and the other into that of his waistcoat, hastily tied up a small bundle of linen, and rushing towards the door disappeared in the darkness of the night. Then all became clear and manifest to me, and I reproached myself with what had happened as though I myself had done the guilty deed. I fancied that I still heard faint moans, and imagining that the unfortunate jeweller might not be quite dead, I determined to go to his relief, by way of atoning in some slight degree, not for the crime I had committed, but for that which I had not endeavoured to prevent. For this purpose I applied all the strength I possessed to force an entrance from the cramped spot in which I lay to the adjoining room. The badly arranged planks, which alone divided me from it, yielded to my efforts, and I found myself in the house. Hastily snatching up the lighted candle, I hurried to the staircase. Towards the middle of it, I stumbled over a human body lying quite across the stairs. As I stooped to raise it, I discovered in the agonized features those of La Carconte. The pistol I had heard had doubtless been discharged at the unfortunate woman whose throat it had frightfully lacerated, leaving a gaping wound from which, as well at the mouth, the blood was welling in sanguinary streams. Finding the miserable creature past all human aid, I strode past her and ascended to the sleeping chamber, which presented an appearance of the wildest disorder. The furniture had been knocked over in the deadly struggle that had taken place there, and the sheets to which the unfortunate jeweller had doubtless clung were dragged across the room. The murdered man lay on the ground, his head leaning against the wall, weltering in a gory stream, poured forth from three large wounds in his breast. There was a fourth gash, but the blood was prevented escaping in consequence of the weapon, a large table knife still sticking in it. I stumbled over some object. I stooped to examine. It was the second pistol, which had not gone off, probably from the powder being wet. I approached the jeweller, who was not quite dead, and at the sound of my footsteps, causing as they did the creaking of the floor, he opened his eyes, fixed them on me with an anxious and inquiring gaze, moved his lips as though trying to speak, then, overcome by the effort, fell back and expired. This appalling sight almost bereft me of my senses, and finding that I could no longer be of service to anyone in the house, my only desire was to fly from such an accumulation of horrors as quickly as I could. Almost distracted, I rushed towards the staircase, clasping my burning temples with both hands and uttering cries of horror. Upon reaching the room below, I found five or six custom house officers, accompanied by an armed troop of soldiery, who immediately seized me, ere indeed I had sufficiently collected my ideas to offer any resistance. In truth, my senses seemed to have wholly forsaken me, and when I strove to speak, a few inarticulate sounds alone escaped my lips. As I noticed the significant manner in which the whole party pointed my blood-stained garments, I involuntarily surveyed myself, and then I discovered that the thick, warm drops that had so bedewed me as I lay beneath the staircase must have been the blood of La Carconte. Paralysed with horror, I could barely indicate by a movement of my hand the spot where I had concealed myself. "What does he mean?" asked a gendarme. One of the officers went to the place I directed. "He means," replied the man upon his return, "that he effected his entrance by means of this hole," showing the place where I had broken my way through the planks into the house. Then, and not before, the true nature of my situation flashed on me, and I saw that I was considered the guilty author of all that had occurred. With this frightful conviction of my danger, I recovered force and energy enough to free myself from the hands of those who held me, while I managed to stammer forth, "I did not do it! Indeed, indeed, I did not!" A couple of gendarmes held the muzzles of their carbines against my breast. "Stir but a step," said they, "and you are a dead man." "Why should you threaten me with death," cried I, "when I have already declared my innocence?" "Tush, tush," cried the men, "keep your innocent stories to tell to the judge at Nîmes. Meanwhile, come along with us, and the best advice we can give you is to do so unresistingly." Alas, resistance was far from my thoughts. I was utterly overpowered by surprise and terror, and without a word I suffered myself to be handcuffed and tied to a horse's tail, in which disgraceful plight I arrived at Nîmes. It seems I had been tracked by an officer who lost sight of me near the tavern. Feeling assured that I intended to pass the night there, he had returned to summon his comrades, who had just arrived in time to hear the report of the pistol, and to take me in the midst of such circumstantial proofs of my guilt as rendered all hopes of proving my innocence utterly at an end. One only chance was left me, that of beseeching the magistrate before whom I was taken to cause every inquiry to be made for an individual named the Abbé Busoni, who had stopped at the inn of the Pont du Gard on the morning previous to the murder. If, indeed, Caderousse had not invented the story relative to the diamond, and that there existed no such person as the Abbé Busoni, in which case I was lost past redemption, or at least my life hung upon the feeble chance of Caderousse himself being apprehended and confessing the whole truth. 2 months passed away in hopeless expectation on my part, while I must do the magistrate justice by declaring he used every means to obtain information of the person I declared could exculpate me if he would. Caderousse still evaded all pursuit, and I had resigned myself to what seemed my inevitable fate. My trial was to come on at the approaching sessions, when on the 8th of September, that is to say, precisely 3 months and 5 days after the events which had perilled my life, the Abbé Busoni, whom I never ventured to believe I should see, presented himself at the prison doors, saying he understood one of the prisoners wished to speak to him. He added that, having learned the particulars of my imprisonment, he hastened to comply with my desire. You may easily imagine with what eagerness I welcomed him, and how minutely I related the whole of what I had seen and heard. I felt some degree of nervousness as I entered upon the history of the diamond, but to my inexpressible astonishment he confirmed it in every particular, and to my equal surprise he seeked to place entire belief in all I stated. And then it was that, won by his mild charity, perceiving him acquainted with all the habits and customs of my own country, and considering also that pardon for the only crime of which I was really guilty might come with a double power from lips so benevolent and kind, I besought him to receive my confession, under the seal of which I recounted the affair of Auteuil, in all its details, as well as every other transaction of my life. That which I had done by the impulse of my best feelings produced the same effect as though it had been the result of calculation. My voluntary confession of the assassination at Auteuil proved to him that I had not committed that with which I stood accused. When he quitted me, he bade me be of good courage, and rely upon his doing all in his power to convince my judges of my innocence. I had speedy proofs that the excellent abbé was engaged in my behalf, for the rigours of my imprisonment were alleviated by many trifling though acceptable indulgences, and I was told that my trial was to be postponed to the assizes following those now being held. In the interim, it pleased Providence to cause the apprehension of Caderousse, who was discovered in some distant country and brought back to France, where he made a full confession, refusing to make the fact of his wife's having suggested and arranged the murder any excuse for his own guilt. The wretched man was sentenced to the galleys for life, and I immediately set at liberty. "And then it was, I presume," said Monte Cristo, "that you came to me as the bearer of a letter from the Abbé Busoni."
"It was, Your Excellency. The benevolent abbé took an evident interest in all that concerned me. 'Your mode of life as a smuggler,' said he to me one day, 'will be the ruin of you if you persist in it. Let me advise you, when you get out of prison, to choose something more safe as well as respectable.' 'But how,' inquired I, 'am I to maintain myself and my poor sister?' 'A person, whose confessor I am,' replied he, 'and who entertains a high regard for me, applied to me a short time since to procure him a confidential servant. Would you like such a post? If so, I will give you a letter of introduction to the friend I allude to.' 'With thankfulness shall I profit by your permitting me to wait upon the gentleman you speak of.' 'One thing you must do. Swear solemnly that I shall never have reason to repent my recommendation.' I extended my hand, and was about to pledge myself by any promise he would dictate, but he stopped me. 'It is unnecessary for you to bind yourself by any vow,' said he. 'I know and admire the Corsican nature too well to fear you. Here, take this,' continued he, after rapidly writing the few lines I brought to Your Excellency, and upon receipt of which you deigned to receive me into your service, 'and I venture most respectfully and humbly to ask whether Your Excellency has ever had cause to repent after having done so.'
'On the contrary, Bertuccio, I have ever found you faithful, honest, and deserving. One fault I find with you, and that is your not having placed sufficient confidence in me.'
'Indeed, Your Excellency, I know not what you mean.'
"'Simply this. How comes it that, having both a sister and an adopted son, you have never spoken to me of either?'
"'Alas! I have still to recount the most distressing period of my life.'"
End of Disc 15. Disc 16.
"'Alas! I have still to recount the most distressing period of my life.' Anxious, as you may suppose, I was to behold and comfort my dear sister. I lost no time in hastening to Corsica, but when I arrived at Rogliano, I found a house of mourning and of desolation, the consequences of a scene so horrible that the neighbours remember and speak of it to this day. Acting by my advice, my poor sister had refused to comply with the unreasonable demands of Benedetto, who was continually tormenting her for money, as long as he believed there was a sou left in her possession. One morning that he had demanded money, threatening her with the severest consequences if she did not supply him with what he desired, he disappeared throughout the whole of the day, leaving the kind-hearted Assunta, who loved him as if he were her own child, to weep over his conduct and bewail his absence. Evening came, and still with all the patient solicitude of a mother she watched for his return. As the 11th hour struck, he entered with a swaggering air, attended by two of the most dissolute and reckless of his ordinary companions. As poor Assunta rose to clasp her truant in her arms, forgetting all but the happiness of seeing him again, she was seized upon by the three ruffians, while the unnatural Benedetto exclaimed, "Come, if the old girl refuses to tell us where she keeps her money, let us just give her a taste of the torture. That will make her find her tongue, I'll engage." It unfortunately happened that our neighbour, Wasilio, was at Bastia, leaving no person in his house but his wife. No human creature except she could hear or see anything that took place within our dwelling.
Two of the brutal companions of Benedetto held poor Assunta, who, unable to conceive that any harm was intended to her, smiled innocently and kindly in the face of those who were soon to become her executioners, while the third ruffian proceeded to barricade the doors and windows. Then, returning to his infamous accomplices, the three united in stifling the cries uttered by the poor victim at the sight of these alarming preparations. This effected, they dragged the unoffending object of their barbarity towards the fire, on which they forcibly held her feet, expecting by this diabolical expedient to wring from her where her supposed treasure was secreted. In the struggles made by my poor sister, her clothes caught fire, and her fiendish and cowardly tormentors were compelled to let go their hold in order to preserve themselves from sharing the same fate. Covered with flames, Assunta rushed wildly to the door, but it was fastened. Tortured by the agony she endured, the unfortunate sufferer flew to the windows, but they were also strongly barricaded. Then her cries and shrieks of anguish filled the place. To these succeeded convulsive sobs and deep groans, which, subsiding in faint moans, at length died away, and all was still as the grave. Next morning, as soon as the wife of Wasilio could muster up courage to venture abroad, she caused the door of our dwelling to be opened by the public authorities, when Assunta, though dreadfully burnt, was found still breathing. Every drawer and closet in the house had been forced open, and everything worth carrying off stolen from them. Benedetto never again appeared at Rogliano, neither have I since that day either seen or heard anything concerning him. It was subsequently to these dreadful events that I waited on Your Excellency, to whom it would have been folly to have mentioned Benedetto, since all trace of him seemed entirely lost, or of my sister, since she was dead.
"And in what light did you view the tragical occurrence?" inquired Monte Cristo.
"As a punishment for the crime I had committed," answered Bertuccio. "Oh, those Villeforts are an accursed race."
"Truly they are," murmured the Count, with a most singular expression of countenance.
"And now," resumed Bertuccio, "Your Excellency may perhaps be able to comprehend that this place, which I revisit for the first time, this garden, the actual scene of my crime, must have given rise to reflections of no very agreeable nature, and produced that gloom and depression of spirit which excited the notice of Your Excellency, who is pleased to express a desire to know the cause. At this instant a shudder passes over me as I reflect that possibly I am now standing on the very grave in which lies Monsieur de Villefort, by whose hand the ground was dug to receive the corpse of his child."
"It may be so," said Monte Cristo, rising from the bench on which he had been sitting. "But," added he in a lower tone, "whether the Procureur du Roi be dead or not, the Abbé Busoni did right to send you to me, and you have also acted extremely properly in relating to me the whole of your history, as it will prevent my forming any erroneous opinions concerning you in future. As for that Benedetto, who so grossly belied his name, have you never made any effort to trace out whether he has gone, or what has become of him?"
"No. Far from wishing to learn whither he had betaken himself, I should have shunned the possibility of meeting him, as I would a wild beast or a savage monster. Thank God I have never heard his name mentioned by any person, and I hope and believe he is dead."
"Flatter not yourself that such is the case," replied the Count. "An all-wise providence permits not sinners to escape thus easily from the punishment they have merited on earth, but reserves them to aid his own designs, using them as instruments whereby to work his vengeance on the guilty."
"I am content to have him live," continued Bertuccio, "so that he spares me the misery of ever again beholding him. And now, Monsieur le Comte," added the steward, bending humbly forward, "you know every secret of my life."
Bertuccio hid his face in his hands as he uttered these words, while Monte Cristo fixed on him a long and indescribable gaze. After a brief silence, rendered still more solemn by the time and place, the Count said, in a tone of melancholy wholly unlike his usual manner,
"In order to bring this conversation to a fitting termination, as I promise you never again to revert to it, I will repeat to you some words I have heard from the lips of the Abbé Busoni himself, and which I recommend you to treasure up for your consolation, that all earthly ills yield to two all-potent remedies, time and silence. And now leave me. I would enjoy the cool solitude of this place. The very circumstances which inflict on you as a principal in the tragic scene enacted here such painful emotions are to me, on the contrary, a source of extreme delight, and serve but to enhance the value of this dwelling in my estimation. Retire within, Bertuccio, and tranquilize your mind.
Should your confessor be less indulgent to you in your dying moments than you found the Abbé Busoni, send for me, if I am still on earth, and I will soothe your ear with words that shall effectually calm and soothe your parting soul." Bertuccio bowed lowly and respectfully, and turned away, sighing heavily as he quitted his patron. When he had quite disappeared, Monte Cristo arose, and taking three or four steps onwards, he murmured, "Here, beneath this plane tree, must have been where the infant's grave was dug. There is the little door opening into the garden. At this corner is the private staircase communicating with the sleeping apartment. There will be no necessity for me to make a note of these particulars, for there, before my eyes, beneath my feet, all around me, I have the plan sketched with all the living reality of truth." After making the tour of the garden a second time, the Count regained the house and re-entered his carriage, while Bertuccio, who perceived the thoughtful expression of his master's features, took his seat beside the driver without uttering a word. The carriage proceeded rapidly towards Paris. That same evening, upon reaching his abode in the Champs-Élysées, the Count of Monte Cristo went over the whole building with the air of one long acquainted with each nook or corner. Nor, although preceding the party, did he once mistake one door for another, or commit the smallest error when choosing any particular corridor or staircase to conduct him to a place or suite of rooms he desired to visit. Ali was his principal attendant during the somewhat late hour of his survey. Having given various orders to Bertuccio relative to the improvements and alterations he desired to make in the house, the Count, drawing out his watch, said to the attentive Nubian, "It is 11:30. A day will not be long ere she arrives. Have the French attendants been summoned to await her coming?" Ali extended his hands towards the apartments destined for the fair Greek, which were at a distance from the habitable part of the dwelling, and so effectually concealed by means of a tapestried entrance that it would have puzzled the most curious to have divined that beyond that spot lay hid a suite of rooms fitted up with a rich magnificence worthy of the lovely being who was to tenant them. Ali, having pointed to the apartments, counted three on the fingers of his right hand, and then, placing it beneath his head, shut his eyes and feigned to sleep. "I understand," said Monte Cristo, well acquainted with Ali's pantomime. "You mean to tell me that three female attendants await their new mistress in her sleeping chamber?" Ali, with considerable animation, made a sign in the affirmative. "The young lady must needs be fatigued with her journey," continued Monte Cristo, "and will, no doubt, wish to retire to rest immediately upon her arrival. Desire the French attendants not to weary her with questions, but merely to pay their respectful duty and retire. You will also see that the Greek servant holds no communication with those of this country." Ali bowed obediently and reverentially. Just at that moment voices were heard hailing the concierge. The gate opened, a carriage rolled down the avenue and stopped at the flight of steps leading to the house. The Count hastily descended and presented himself at the already opened carriage door to assist a young female, completely enveloped in a mantle of green and gold, to alight. The female raised a hand extended towards her to her lips and kissed it with a mixture of love and respect. Some few words passed between them in that sonorous language in which Homer makes his gods converse. The female spoke with an expression of deep tenderness, while the Count replied with an air of gentle gravity. Preceded by Ali, who carried a rose-coloured flambeau in his hand, the female, who was no other than the lovely Greek, who had been Monte Cristo's companion in Italy, was conducted to her apartments, while the Count retired to the pavilion reserved for himself. In another hour, every light in the house was extinguished.